Hello and welcome back to the Brad Pitt Cast, the podcast about Brad Pitt.
You always start this podcast laughing. Is it the nervous? Is it the anxiety?
I don't think I'm that anxious. I think it's the absurdity of being in a situation in which I'm introducing a Brad Pitt cast.
It's great.
I'm Dan.
I'm Joseph.
This is Joseph. Welcome.
Welcome. I'm so excited to have you here. I'm so excited to be here with my friend Dan. We're not in the fort. We're upstairs.
We've shifted location. This is the third podcast location, actually.
That's true. We'll just explore my entire house.
Well, we did my apartment.
Wow, true. We did yours. We did your place. Yeah, we'll fucking go around the world. Let's take it on tour.
We should.
We do. I mean, this
if anyone wants to host an episode of the Brad Pitt
Cast,
let
we'll
us
come
know.
To your fucking house.
Yeah.
We're a minimal operation. We're a podcasting microphone.
We've got our mic and a laptop.
Yeah.
And some headphones and us.
And that's it.
The Brad Pitt Cast at gmail.com. Let us know.
This is a podcast dedicated to Brad Pitt. We are slowly making our way through his career, one film per week. We started off doing Ad Astra, his most recent film, which we will return to.
That's
Dan reminded me of today. Our last episode of this podcast will be Ad Astra again, retake. This is, last week was a pivotal episode of our show because we were insane.
We were insane. That was a real wild evening.
I mean, I guess that evening happened a week ago. It feels like it happened about 10 years ago.
It feels like it's contained in its own little time capsule of madness. Yeah.
We were rough. We fucked up the mics, so it sounds insane.
Yeah, the first half is recorded directly onto my laptop because of some audio issues, and it sounds weird, and then has a rat. If you look at the sound wave for the podcast halfway through, it just blows out.
It's, you know, this is something we've quoted before, so this is a throwback. Wes Craven said about Texas Chainsaw Massacre that it feels like someone stole a camera, killed someone, and made a movie.
Yeah.
That episode of the podcast sounds like we have all just got away with, like,
something.
We've done something terrible.
Yeah. Which is actually exactly what happens in Thelma and Louise.
That's true.
So maybe we're just imitating the arc
of Thelma and Louise. Yeah. Which was a film that we struggled with a little bit.
I'm going to go back to that at some point and rewatch it. And if I do, I'll update you down the line, but I don't know.
It's been pointed out to us. We listened to the TV edit, which is insane. We watched the TV edit. It's possible that we would have liked it more.
I think it is almost inevitable that we would. And maybe, I don't know, maybe if we watched it in a more controlled environment, I feel
when
like
we
it
weren't
was
insane.
Evening. It felt rough.
I have, like, you know when you have evenings that are so crazy, you have, like, a sense memory?
Yeah.
Before I even think about, like, what actually happened, I just feel weird.
Yeah.
What the fuck happened to us?
It's a really good question.
We ate Thai. Maybe the Thai was funny.
We ate Thai afterwards.
Did we?
Yeah.
We were already crazy. Yeah. That's no good, Dan. This week we're feeling more calm.
So far.
We're feeling pretty good.
Yeah.
We're here to talk about a film that it is difficult to talk about for a number of reasons. As has kind of been the case with almost every film so far.
You wouldn't think so. We didn't expect this going in, I guess.
No. So the film is called Johnny Suede.
Yeah.
Written and directed by a man called Tom DiCillo.
Mm.
I guess first we should do a tiny bit of Pitt context. So DiCillo hires Pitt, and Thelma and Louise has not come out when he hires him. But there's a buzz in Hollywood. Are you looking because you can hear the birds?
No. I'm just thinking about Pitt context.
You looked with such... I was like, oh my God, is it... Because the birds are quite loud.
I think it provides pleasant background music. It's a bed of birds.
Yeah. So DiCillo casts Pitt not having seen Thelma and Louise, but everyone in Hollywood is talking about, hey, there's this young guy, he's really hot.
My father, during a camping trip once from, like, there was some camping site... a gift shop, and he bought a little cassette tape of bird calls, and we listened to that on the remainder of the trip home, and it was a British woman's voice saying the name of each bird.
That is...
And then there would be the bird call.
I mean, I am shocked, but I'm also not shocked.
It's coherent within the universe of...
We have to
things
get your
dad
on does.
We will, yeah, no, at some point we'll interview him about something.
Yeah. That's the craziest shit I've ever heard.
Anyway, that my mind went there when we're talking about bird calls. Brad Pitt, young, hot, new actor in Hollywood.
So nobody knows. So we were talking about this when we were watching the film. It's been interesting to talk about Pitt because we've been talking about someone who is not making decisions as an auteur yet.
Yes, unformed and being buffeted by the winds of Hollywood.
He's taken jobs that come to him, which will not happen very often quite soon.
Yeah.
But it means you have to talk about these films like Johnny Swaite. So who does he play? He plays a throwback rockabilly wannabe guy out of time, big hairdo.
Pompadour.
So you'd want to say like, oh, this is reaction against playing idiots in Thelma and Louise.
He's kind of playing into stereotypes and subverting them.
Yeah, but, it's not a choice.
You wonder, I mean, what I wouldn't give for a list of all the films Pitt auditioned for at this phase of his career.
Sure.
Like, what level is he aiming for? What's he getting turned down from? Who is getting cast in his place? Because you can imagine that the life he is living at the moment is, you know, calling his agent, auditioning for everything that comes up.
Yeah. Journalism student with like three films to his name who's like, fucking, I'll take anything.
Yeah.
Which is weird. You know, another thing that makes this enterprise of this podcast like interesting and maybe slightly weird.
Tell me.
Brad Pitt doesn't talk a lot in interviews. It's quite difficult to find much information about stages in Pitt's life.
Like, he's mysterious.
He's really mysterious. You can't find... He doesn't talk about, this was the audition, or this is what I thought about this job, or... I read there was a really bad article in The Guardian from, like, the early thousands, which I stumbled across because I was trying to find out stuff about the Wachowskis. And it was an interview, a terrible, like, very transphobic piece, which was the writer trying to write about the fact that Lana and Lily Wachowski had just transitioned without getting sued. So the article was actually about, like, just directors being reclusive, basically. And the really interesting thing that the writer said about the Coen brothers, they're hiding in plain sight. They open their mouths and they talk, but they don't really say anything, which is true. If you watch a Coen brothers interview, you're often like, well, they haven't told me anything.
Yeah.
They're so fucking inscrutable, which is not surprising.
Very strange series of interviews Oprah did with the Coen brothers and Cormac McCarthy when No Country for Old Men came out. Yeah. It's one of the weirdest things. They're very short. I read this years ago when I was, for some reason, I realized McCarthy never gives interviews to anyone. And I saw somewhere that he'd given an interview to Oprah. I thought, I have to find out about this. I'm pretty sure that's right.
It sounds good. Let's pretend it's true.
Cormac McCarthy definitely gave an interview to Oprah. That 100%.
I feel like
he talked to her about The Road. But maybe talk about The Road and No Country for Old Men anyway.
Possibly. He was weirdly everywhere around No Country for Old Men. I think he really liked that movie.
Fair enough. It's a good film.
I think that movie's the reason why he writes The Counselor. I haven't read that anyway.
Makes sense.
But the timeline makes perfect sense that he sees that movie and he's like, this is fun.
Yeah.
Because do you remember, it's one of those weird images burnt in my head. When there was that year at the Oscars where No Country for Old Men wins, like, everything. As Dan's laptop contributed into our conversation.
Making sure it's plugged in.
There was that crazy year at the Oscars where there was No Country for Old Men wins everything.
That's right, yeah.
Over There Will Be Blood. And I remember watching it and I was rooting for There Will Be Blood. But like, how do you choose?
Yeah, no, with those two films.
There Will Be Blood means
everyone
more
deserves
to me.
I've seen There Will Be Blood multiple times. I've only seen No Country for Old Men once. I think No Country for Old Men might be a more kind of coherently successful film. As just There Will Be Blood's wild.
I
like it. Obviously, it's an extraordinary piece. But it's, I mean, look, you're not going to like this. But I think maybe There Will Be Blood is a bit too melodramatic.
I don't not like that. I just... We agree, but we have different emotional responses.
Sure.
I love melodrama.
Yeah, okay.
That film is insane at the end. When he's going like...
Yeah, I don't know if it earns that.
Oh, it's beautiful. The way that the film is going quite well, and then suddenly you cut to Daniel Day-Lewis and he's living in a fucking house, like completely... I love that.
Sure.
There's this whole bit that you just don't see.
Yeah.
Do you know Quentin Tarantino's read on that film?
No, tell me.
That... The secret message of that film is Daniel Plainview has to do such horrible things that P.T. Anderson doesn't show you. You know when the film starts with Daniel, like, falling down the mine?
That's right, yeah.
And like, you don't see how he gets back to civilization. Yeah. You cut forward. Quentin Tarantino thinks that, like, such terrible shit happens there that it informs the person he then is.
That's interesting. I mean, that makes sense because the way in which the film is framed
functions
as...
Yeah,
because that makes sense to his character arc entirely.
Because, I mean,
loses his mind.
Yeah, he's not a nice person, but then suddenly he's fucking, like, Count Dracula in a castle, like, shooting bottles and killing preachers. Spoiler alert for There Will Be Blood.
With a bowling pin.
Fucking Dan.
I know, I like it. It's a great movie.
It's a great movie.
B plus.
What? No,
I'm joking, I'm joking.
I was listening back to our other episode the other day, and I feel like the single clip of the podcast that most explains what we're like as a podcast is the moment where I ask you what's the worst shorthand for the worst film, and you say The Room.
Sure.
And I say, what the fuck? And you have immediate panic. You're like, don't do this to me. I think is what you say.
Yeah, probably. I mean,
that's us.
I think that is our vibe. I think we have different. I think a lot of this is kind of working out what each of us think quality refers to.
Yeah. That's the ongoing project of this podcast, I think.
But we both agree that it can refer to Brad Pitt.
Yeah, because he's the fucking best.
He's great.
I just have to quickly tie the thread through that There Will Be Blood thing.
Thank you.
The Oscars where No Country for Old Men wins everything.
Mm.
There is one shot that for some reason burned in my memory that when they win the Best Picture, Cormac McCarthy doesn't go up on stage with the Coen brothers.
Sure.
But he stands up and applauds and looks... I don't know. It's the most... I feel moved reflecting on it. Because it's a beautiful...
He's happy.
He's so proud of them.
Oh, that's nice.
He's so proud of them. Because Oscars are like... It's all bullshit.
I'm gonna look this up after the podcast.
Yeah. There's a tiny cutaway. And he looks like...
Authentic.
It really meant something to him. Because he was proud of... He was proud of Joel and Ethan. Those young boys. That's lovely.
Because you imagine him as just being permanently abrasive... Cormac McCarthy. You
imagine him like constantly dripping with cattle blood and like made out of moonshine and like
talking
resentment.
Monosyllabically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What a fucking.
I'm at the Oscars. I wonder who dressed him.
Yeah. You could write a short story called Cormac McCarthy at the Oscars. Oscars.
Yeah. I think,
That you would win several prizes. Let's fucking do it.
A narrative podcast.
Oh my God.
Can you imagine? Like Night Vale.
Yeah, it's just Cormac McCarthy's interior monologue.
At the Oscars.
Yeah. What does Cormac McCarthy...
the firmament.
Well, because fucking, you know, Cormac McCarthy writes The Counselor that Brad Pitt is in.
Yeah, it's true.
What does Cormac McCarthy think when he meets Brad Pitt? Or maybe he never did.
I mean, we're going to have this conversation in more depth at some point, but I think Brad Pitt could absolutely be... And it's a while since I've read this, but I feel like the protagonist of All the Pretty Horses.
Sure.
I think McCarthy is very familiar with the kind of... youthful, strong, naive...
Wild buck.
Americana.
Yeah.
So I think I think he fits into an archetype that McCarthy appreciates and understands.
I think that's true. I think Pitt could also be in... What's the one that they keep trying to make? Blood Meridian.
Oh, yeah. Who would he be? Maybe a young Pitt could have been the kid.
That's true.
But he could be someone in the gang.
Do you think they'll ever make Blood Meridian into a movie? I don't know how they do it. That's why no one can.
Impossible. It would be so upsetting. I mean, you'd have to caricature it or make it so confronting that no one would want to see it.
The violence has to be funny, I think.
And also, how do you do that dialogue? Because the counselor was insane, but the counselor, at least, its insanity was contextualized in kind of modern America, which makes there was a sense of bizarreness and surreality that works in that moment because. It's surreal, it's postmodern, but how do you do that with that Western, like a deep, dark, biblical Western?
Because for those who haven't read Blood Meridian, it's maybe 120 pages long, and basically...
No, it's longer, I think it's like 300 pages.
Oh.
Yeah, Blood Meridian's a solid novel.
Huh.
It speeds by.
It's basically just violence.
There's probably 120 pages of violence in the 300 pages.
The book starts and there's like 6 or 7 murders.
Yeah, there's a horrifying... Well, I won't actually describe... But there are a set of deeply disturbing set pieces.
And Ridley Scott has owned the film rights since the 90s. And no one can make it.
Yeah.
Because no one can fucking direct it. Maybe Brad Pitt should direct it.
Well, that would be something.
What does Brad Pitt movie directed by Brad Pitt look like? He would probably make some stoner comedy that gets real sad in the final scene.
Yeah, I buy that.
Some slice of life.
Or maybe he does the like... high school drama thing. Or like high school comedy even.
Yeah.
I feel like he has his...
Because he's funny.
He is funny.
So funny.
Yeah.
Weird. We're desperately avoiding talking about Johnny Suede. Let's do a brief logline of Johnny Suede.
Yeah.
Let's briefly do the plot. And then there's fun stuff to talk about that's not necessarily in the movie itself.
Okay.
So Johnny Suede is a film about a throwback rocker who is played by...
Brad Pitt.
Bradley J. Pitts, who's totally disinterested in the modern world. He doesn't like it. He wants to be a singer of like a throwback rockabilly band.
We know this because he plays his guitar in his room with his pompadour.
And he's got jackets. A big old pompadour.
A lot of different jackets.
He's got photos of Elvis on the walls.
Yeah. He's also, his apartment is a hovel.
Yes.
It's a bad scene.
Yeah, it looks tough. And he's just, in a very early in the film, he just writes his name on the wall.
That's right. After he has genuinely... So this is, broadly, my feelings about this film. Not a good film.
Sure.
Some very entertaining moments.
It's the first...
That function in terms of... When I say it's not a good film, it's a total vision. It's fine. Mm-hmm. It wants to do something, it sets out to do it. And it basically executes that.
It's the first film that we've watched so far that aims to do something that's actually kind of interesting and does it pretty well.
In a reasonably interesting way.
We haven't seen... maybe that sounds controversial because we did Thelma and Louise last week. I guess you could say that. That's this is true. More idiosyncratic.
Yeah, this is more contained. This is just doing one thing. I feel like Thelma and Louise is much more ambitious.
Yeah, Thelma and Louise is like a feminist blockbuster that plays with about four different genres. This is... a mood piece about a character that's extremely aimless.
It's an art film.
It's an art film. We have just stumbled across, about 10 minutes before we started recording this podcast, an extremely bizarre profile on the New Yorker. Or is it the New York Times? New York Times, talking about this film.
But not the film as such, but the film's opening. So sure. The premiere.
Because I think they knew that Brad Pitt was going to be a big deal. Because there's a line, where is it? He says, the writer says something like, after initial shooting frenzy...
So meaning Brad Pitt walks in, a lot of snaps.
During which the young star, who has been touted as the next big thing, stood around looking accessible with his hands in his pockets.
Yeah. So people are talking about Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
So just to be clear, Johnny Suede is released in 92, a year after Thelma and Louise, which was released in 91. So there's buzz, presumably, from Thelma and Louise.
Yeah. It's one of these... This is a thing that happens quite often in Hollywood, is that, like, a movie star films something before their big break, and then the thing that they filmed gets rushed through production because they're like, oh, this person's big now. Happened with, when Jennifer Lawrence got big, do you remember shortly after Lawrence got big and Academy nominated and was doing the chalk show circuit, they rushed out this horror film called The House at the End of the Street.
Oh, yeah. Is she in that?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that film had shot before she got big. She got big and they were like, let's rush it out. Let's get it to cinemas immediately. Good. I kind of like that film.
Sure.
It's very basic, but like, it's lean and mean in a way that I find like genuinely quite interesting. Anyway, so Pitt is like becoming a big deal. So that's what makes this film interesting, right? Yeah. Is that, like, if this guy doesn't go on to be Brad Pitt, you maybe have no reason to talk about it. Because this film cost $500,000, made $10,000 at the box office.
Sure.
So it did very badly.
Yeah.
Extremely bad. Like, $500,000 is not hard to recoup. Particularly if this is the guy that everyone saw with his shirt off in Thelma and Louise.
Yeah.
It's
got an angle. You can imagine a trailer for it that made it look kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. I guess I guess we're dealing pre-Pulp Fiction. So maybe there's...
not the interest in kind of indie cinema.
Indie, American, cool, hip.
Yeah.
Because one thing it's I did want to say... It's... we should point out, the thing that we're skirting around that we will get to is this film has extremely misogynistic politics.
Yeah.
And that's not... I think you would show that to even someone who would say that like political culture has gone too far would see this film and be like,
it's controversial that this film is a misogynist film.
It has violence against women that's meant to be in an offhand, even funny way.
Because the film's tone sets out to be playful and I don't want to say quite trivial, but
sure. No, it's fluffy.
Yeah.
Because it's not, this film wouldn't, it's not browbeating
it's
you
not
with a message.
It's not taking anything seriously, which is a problem because it has a bunch of serious themes that just are not dealt with in any kind of... Or not contextualized in any way that makes them earned or interesting or commented on with any value.
In the first 10 minutes, Pitt walks past a woman who the men are saying is being sexually assaulted, yeah, basically. They're like, they invite Pitt to join
in. It's like on a street and there's like an alleyway and Pitt walks past it.
And he goes and calls the cops. And it bears nothing on the plot, which I guess is the thing that it's hard to talk about because the film doesn't even really have a political thesis. That turns thesis.
Out to foreshadow, if the film has a political thesis, it's that women are nags or incomprehensible, maybe. But the thing is, the film is not even putting that front and center of itself.
No.
It's just part of the tapestry of the film.
Yeah.
So it's not like, it's not putting that forward in any meaningful or substantive way.
Because it is about women. It's basically about Pitt's character, Johnny Suede, meeting about two women. And
in order to be about Pitt, it kind of passes his experience through women.
Yeah. So he dates a woman who we learn almost immediately is being beaten by her partner.
Yeah.
That never gets resolved. And he kind of breaks up with her. And then he starts dating a second woman played by Catherine Keener. Who, when we first meet Keener, someone is perving on her.
That's right.
So already difficult. And then he kind of breaks up with her, gets back together. He punches her.
Yeah.
She
throws a shoe at him, and he complains about her having thrown a shoe at him extensively.
So
he punches her.
So the film has a lot of regressive, misogynistic violence.
Also, and I obviously say this in no way to forgive the film, but just to kind of contextualize it, Johnny Suede is like played as a dope.
Yeah.
And none of these actions are endorsed by the film.
Are they not? They're a little bit endorsed.
Sure, I just mean they're not explicitly. You're not meant to be cheering him on.
I think sometimes they kind of want you to cheer. He punches Keener in the stomach at the end of the film, and they reconcile before the film actually closes.
Sort of. He says sorry, but she doesn't say anything.
Okay.
I'm in no way forgiving this film. I think it's more unsure of itself than anything else.
Well, it's not really presenting anything, which is why it's hard to talk about its politics. Because if this was like some vile,
incel, it would be screwy to take its thesis to account. This is about its vision of the world, not so much its thesis.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing, right, about context, is that like, you're making jokes or you're saying things that just don't play anymore.
Totally.
So it looks like you're making some grand statement, but actually, writer-director Tom DiGillo, I think, was just padding out a film.
Totally. I mean, the interesting thing about the context of this is that the protagonist is someone who is clearly nostalgic for the 50s.
Yeah.
In every sense. He wears these suede shoes and is playing 50s-style music, and everyone he meets is like, why are you playing this music? Be cool. This is old fashioned. And he insists that, you know, he's timeless, but which obviously isn't the case. But in fact, the film also has, you know, 50s politics around women as well. So the film is regressive in a similar way to Brad Pitt.
It's true.
But it does not at all seem to be making a comment that cultural regressiveness functions as a cover for political regressiveness, even though that's kind of what happens.
It's also interesting that we were talking about this when the film was on, that like, I think the style of film about like a lovable character who longs for the past.
Because he is like in his stupidity, he is naive and meant to be lovable.
Yeah, he's kind of like a man out of time, and he's just bumming about the place. I think that genre of film was killed by, and I fucking hate talking about this man or talking about politics, but I think it was killed by Donald Trump.
Mm.
I think the nostalgia, the aggressive nostalgia, we need to take things back to the way they were, has been totally co-opted by Trump.
Sure. I buy that.
Because where are those movies now?
Yeah, I can't think of any.
The past now is a sad, difficult thing that you have to somehow reconcile. That's what blockbusters are about now.
That's true.
Because every fucking film, every American film has to be about Donald fucking Trump.
Yeah.
You know, when Joan Didion's new journal, they published
the South and West, right?
Yeah, they published the writer Joan Didion's journals from
Extraordinary the 70s. Writer, one of the best American writers.
Yeah, so she wrote this in the 70s. And I remember there was a New York Times review and the headline was like,
oh, I think I remember
this. Joan Didion's South and West doesn't say anything about Trump's America. Yeah, fucking fine!
Yeah.
Why do we have to talk about
There's enough content.
Everyone is so bored.
Yeah.
Everyone's so fucking... That's why no one can make fun of Donald Trump, because you put some... You put Alec Baldwin in a fucking wig and orange makeup one time. It's not funny again. I'm so sick of Donald Trump. I'm so sick of the discourse. I'm so sick of the well-being shit. The problem is...
Tell me.
Trump makes the world bad, but not in a way that's fun to talk about.
No.
Or make fun of, because it's so ugly and crude.
Yeah.
He's not... You know, I was thinking about Nixon.
Yeah. You may not be able to hear it being picked up by the mic, but there's a barking dog. Tell me about Nixon. He was fun.
I think Nixon was more fun.
Sure.
I was thinking, why does everyone love the idea? I'm reading the second volume of the column, the comic book, Transmetropolitan, by Warren Ellis.
Okay, oh, I know about Warren Ellis.
Work of art.
All right.
And that plays on this image of Nixon's... Why are you laughing? Because I call everything a work of art. I love
this podcast, Joe. Sincerely.
That comic plays on imagery of the president sequestered in a room doing the tragic King Lear thing.
Oh, yeah. I have heard of this, actually.
So does Succession and all these things.
Yeah.
And those are all Nixon-esque images to me.
It's true.
People have fun because Nixon was
the president in the world of Succession is not Donald Trump.
No.
They do have a Bernie Sanders analog, which is one of the less... good things about that show.
That's the Adam McKay influence,
That's true.
He directed the first episode.
Vice, I think.
Oh, what a weird film.
Speaking of Adam McKay and politics.
I mean, McKay is so crude.
You know there was going to be a musical scene in that movie that they filmed and took out? Yeah.
It's not that bad.
It's fine. I mean, in terms of the vocabulary of the film, it would have fitted in quite well.
I think I just don't like Christian Bale very much.
Huh. Well, you don't see Ford versus Ferrari then.
That film looks really bad. Damn. I just don't like Bale really in anything. I also don't think he has good taste. He doesn't choose projects that interest me.
Hmm.
I genuinely think The Dark Knight Rises is my favourite Christian Bale film.
Sure, I buy that. The Dark Knight's pretty good.
I like The Dark Knight. I like the first, everything but the last half hour of The Dark Knight Rises. Because that's when it turns out that Bane's just like some fucking patsy.
That's such a shame. He's such a powerful character.
He's the best character.
Yeah, it's silly. It takes all the power out of that film.
Tom Hardy is great. The whole thing is great. And then they're like, oh, wait, he was just some wet-eyed boy.
Yeah.
And then
that's not interesting.
No. Nolan was so checked out of that fucking film. I don't understand any of the choices he makes in that movie.
It's really weird. I mean, he didn't want to make a third Batman film, right?
No.
They forced him to.
with a gun.
Okay, well, I don't know where I'm getting that from.
No, it's true. Yeah. They send him down to the Batman mines. They're like, Chris, go on.
Like Daniel Craig and James Bond.
Apparently. Yeah.
It's just offering them millions of dollars, obviously. That's the mines.
The way that Craig said, I would slit my wrists before I made another Bond film. Yeah. And then he made another Bond film.
You got to respect that.
I love Daniel Craig. He looks so unhappy, but that he's enjoying being unhappy. Yeah, he's a misanthrope. Have you seen... We'll get back to Jonas Reed in a minute. Have you seen the insane Daniel Craig film that I can't remember the name of that I'm going to have to start looking up?
When he's in like a militia in...
No, Defiance, I think that's called.
That's called Defiance.
There's a film with him...
The answer to this is almost certainly going to be no.
Which is a dramedy.
Uh-huh.
Which pivots...
British or America?
British. Which pivots on Daniel Craig's love interest as a child getting blown up by an unexploded sea mine.
Jeez.
And it's played totally straight.
Oh, I think I've heard about this.
It's the crazy... I have to find
Joe's
it.
Joe's looking it up on his phone.
Joseph
is looking it up on his phone.
Yeah, what the fuck is this film called? Flashbacks of a Fool.
No, I haven't heard of that.
He is an aging Hollywood star, Joe Scott.
Daniel Craig. So and this was made recently.
In 2008.
Okay, God, aging's a bit much.
The death of his childhood best friend, Boots, takes our protagonist and the movie into an extended flashback to a seaside town in 1970s Britain. That death is he gets blown up by a fucking sea mine.
I mean, it happens.
And the film plays...
I hope no one in our audience has been touched by sea mine explosions.
Do people get blown up by sea mines? It must have.
Every now and then in Europe they find unexploded mines. World War II was a...
Sea mines, though, Dan.
They must exist. I'm not... I don't know anything about this. I'm not challenging its plausibility.
You sound pretty sure that, like, you've heard of someone getting blown up by a sea mine.
I haven't. But I can imagine it happening.
I can imagine...
I don't want to... I'm not an expert in this field.
I can imagine someone getting attacked by space monkeys. Doesn't mean I think it happens, like, frequently.
Did you see Ad Astra?
Yes, I did, Daniel. I recorded a podcast episode about it. Why the fuck were you even talking about Daniel Craig?
Hard to track.
Let's go back to James Bond. Johnny Suede.
Yeah. Johnny Suede. So there are, look, the film is has harmful politics, and that makes it generally quite unenjoyable to watch.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should talk about a couple of things. I think we should talk about how the characters in it are played, because I think that's quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And we should also talk about Brad Pitt, but we'll get to Brad Pitt.
Sure.
Obviously, the director is telling his... I mean, something you have said a few times, I don't think you've said it on the podcast yet, is that this is a Jarmusch ripoff. It's like Jarmusch Lite, and that is how it feels.
So Tom DiCillo is friends. He's coming up in the New York indie underground with Jim Jarmusch. And by the 90s, Jarmusch has made like quite a few films. And in fact, Jarmusch had a hand in this film.
Okay.
DiCillo told Jarmusch, "I've had this idea," and Jarmusch was like, "Oh, you should go and write it." Oh,
that's nice.
I think that's about where it ends.
That makes sense. I mean, so, but in a kind of Jarmuschian style, characters speak very flatly.
Well, the interesting thing that we were talking about too is that, so in the 1950s, a bunch of American filmmakers like Nicholas Ray were making really good, formally inventive, what were at the time were seen as B pictures, like gangster movies, like really interesting films, like Pick Up on 52nd Street and all this kind of stuff. Really cool, weird films. They are ignored by American critics, but widely accepted and adored by French filmmakers, chiefly Jean-Luc Godard and François Truffaut, who think that, like, Hitchcock is the best. Sure. They think all these people that the Americans ignore, Nicholas Ray, they adore, obsessed with Nicholas Ray. And so they make... I mean, Godard's a perfect example, right? He takes the genre stuff and he filters it through, like, Marxism and philosophy and just lecturing people.
Yes.
I do not like Jean-Luc Godard. I wish I did. And then, you know, 30 years after that, people in the New York underground, like Jim Jarmusch, are taking Godard and making films about America. They are Americans, but they're making them through a European lens. So that's how you get a film like this.
So it's like reverse translated.
Yeah, so this is American genre, French kind of atmosphere told by an American Tom DiCillo.
I mean, it does sound translated. No one in it speaks like a real person.
No.
And that's the point. I think it conceives of itself as dry and as broadly a comedy. Like, I think
there's some scenes that we were like, quite genuinely laughing.
Actually, visually, there are quite a few, like, elegant jokes.
Mm-hmm.
There's a wonderful scene in which Brad Pitt is heading home from some dejection. He's looking very sad on the train, and there's this little kid on the train with a balloon just staring at him. It's gorgeous. Yeah. And
very dry, laconic. Yeah,
there's a scene where Brad Pitt is considering moving in with a woman, and his friend Deke, I think, who's a painter, is drawing up like a pros and cons list, and Brad Pitt talks about all the food available at this woman's apartment, and Dick says something like, "We'll call that snacks," and writes it in the pro column, which is very funny. There are some genuinely
that scene is cute and funny moments,
but it doesn't quite feel like an accident when those scenes happen, but it feels like just darts are being thrown at a dartboard, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, and this is kind of undershot by a narrative that is just not particularly interesting and gives the audience no reason to invest.
I think what some of that comes down to, and this is very true of what happens in the cinema of Jim Jarmusch, is that, like, Jarmusch makes his films incredibly cheaply, mostly with a crew of film school students. This was certainly true in the past. And, like Claire Denis worked on some Jarmusch films.
Oh, crazy.
Just anyone coming up in the scene, he's like, "Hey, we're shooting this film." She shoots them incredibly quickly. So Jarmusch films, particularly in the 80s and 90s, have this slapdash
feel. DIY.
Yeah, they have this feel of, like, some days everyone had a good day.
Yeah.
And maybe there were some cool people who would just, like, pop by the set and were giving instructions from the side. And some days it was tough. And,
sure.
Johnny Suede feels like that. There are some scenes where...
Yeah.
Maybe Jarmusch is on set saying to DiCillo, like, "You should do that. That's funny." And DiCillo's feeling good and he does funny shit. And other days he feels like he's bored.
Sunset's coming, they got to get it shot quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
It's odd, right? Because this film keeps setting up like a bunch of plot points that never really happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost as if it keeps undermining its own project. Because the basic motivation of Johnny Suede is that he wants to start a band.
Yeah.
And he wants to be a successful singer. And early on there's this fantasy...
pretty good like fantasy.
A
crooner.
It is a great... It's an excellent fantasy scene. Something that would stand out in any... great film.
Yeah.
It's like black and white, I think.
Yeah.
And he is running a up against the microphone, he's doing some real ASMR stuff with like a brush and his suede shoe.
Yeah.
And rubbing the brush against up against the microphone, and there's this audience of beautiful women looking on in hushed awe. And then he says something about how like the qualities of suede, it doesn't crack, is one of them.
It's funny.
It's funny. And then he doesn't even sing. They just all, no. He talks about how great suede is, and they then they burst just into all applause. Applaud.
Yeah.
And then he wakes and writes Johnny Suede on his apartment wall.
See, that's really good. And when you say that, I'm like, oh, maybe this film is great.
It's a good scene.
But it's not.
It's not a great film. It's a shame because there are a bunch of... You know what you could absolutely do? You could make this into a really excellent 15-minute short.
Yeah.
If you cut out almost every scene in which Brad Pitt is acting with other people. Yeah. Not because the other people aren't good. There are some really good performances. Just because interpersonal stuff in this film is broadly uninteresting.
Yeah.
Because what I was saying, right, is he wants to start this band. And there is a scene where he's like, gets a band together and he's in a warehouse...
Samuel L. Jackson is there.
Yeah, Samuel L. Jackson is in the band. For one scene. Yeah, which is very strange. He speculates with his friend Deke about buying a gun so they can get the money to start a band.
Mm.
He tries to get a recording contract by...
giving money to albino Nick Cave,
who we'll talk about.
Sure.
But none of this, not only does none of this ever happen, but the actual kind of stakes and energy of the film are never really invested in whether it happens or not. It's invested specifically in Suede's relationship with these women, which you just never feel good about.
That's extremely Goddard, and that's extremely Jarmusch. They both pilfer from that. Like, Goddard's best film probably is a film called Weekend. Have you seen any Goddard at all?
You know what? I don't think I have.
It's quite skippable. Maybe one day I'll turn around on him. I can imagine one day just...
Richard Brody will convince you.
Christine Korsgaard, the philosopher, once said, "The worry about philosophy is that you won't understand any of it until you've understood all of it."
Mm.
And there are some directors that I think that...
That's really smart.
Korsgaard's the best. She's so good. That quote is so true of most things, I think. But one thing that I think is true is that's true in the case of directors. Sometimes a director vibes with you and you understand like, oh, this is your entire project.
Yeah.
And maybe one day Goddard will just like crack and I'll be evangelical.
Hmm.
Till then.
Yeah.
His films are, because he borrows from American genre, he has the illusion of plot, but he's uninterested in it. So what he steals from American genre is all of the style. And in American genre, the style is tied to plot. And he just takes all the style out. So he has a film called Weekend, which is about two couples that are cheating on each other with each other. And they all hate each other. And it's like extremely dark. And they're going away for a trip. And then they get caught in a traffic jam. And the rest of the film is the traffic jam. Because the traffic jam is like the apocalyptic breakdown of society.
Yeah.
It's a reasonably funny joke, but a difficult film to
sit
through.
Yeah, sounds hard.
So that's what DiCillo, I think, is ripping from. This idea that you, like, thumb your nose at the idea of the plot. Okay. You suggest to the audience, like, there's a journey here, but hey, fuck you, man. Life isn't a journey.
Yeah, which obviously mirrors Brad Pitt's life, which is continually frustrating and difficult. I mean, I would not say this is an especially frustrating film to watch. I will say that it seemed like it went for about 3 hours and it went for 1:40.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's not moving. It never has momentum. Well, it has flashes of energy, but it never has momentum.
Yeah, it's a film that Dan and I was talking. So we watched the film, and then we walked my dog Ida, who is a recurrent ideological character in this podcast. Although she's never said anything on mic.
One day,
she's very shy. What would the film that a dog would guest on? Is it, he's not... Oh, I guess Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
That's true. That's the dog film.
That's the doggiest Brad Pitt film.
Maybe, yeah.
There's nothing else.
I guess not.
What the fuck, Brad Pitt?
Yeah, why doesn't he work with more dogs?
Where's the dogs in your life, Brad, you dickhead? No, I love Brad Pitt. Well, sure. Call him a dickhead.
He's doing fine.
He's a good boy. And when we went for the walk with my dog, we were talking about my habit of, like, obsessively rewatching films, which I do a lot, and you never do. Is there a film that you've watched twice?
Oh, of course. Yeah, no.
Is there a film you've watched three times?
It's a Mad Man Manuel. The Graduate, I've seen a bunch of times. Spinal Tap, I've seen 4 or 5 times. A bunch of Wes Anderson films, I've seen a bunch. I've probably seen Mulholland Drive like 5 times.
Okay.
I saw The Fellowship of the Ring 9 times at the cinema when I was 11.
Of course. Well, because that's unimpeachable, that film.
Yeah.
Genuinely,
I think. There's some films I really like seeing twice.
You just don't do it habitually.
I don't do it alone.
Okay. You don't do it alone?
No.
That's my favourite time.
Oh, you gotta... I'll give it a shot.
And why I think I do that is because I think the first time I'm watching a film, the whole time I'm thinking, is this going to work? Is it going to pull it off? Is it going to convince me? Like, and the second and I'm just scared, Dan.
I get it. No, we all are.
I don't want my heart broken.
I understand.
What? Because I'll turn on a film. If I'm having a good time and it pisses me off and it pisses me off again, I'm out of Ad Astra. Fuck Ad Astra, you know? I do, though. When I
think it really, it amplifies your dislike.
Right? Yeah. If I'm like, oh, you could have something here, and then they drop it in front of me, and then I have to watch them try and like pick it up.
Yeah.
I'm so angry by that stage. So I rewatched again and again and again to learn rhythms, and I can settle into a film, and then I can see what it's doing and saying. This is an example of a film that it actually would really work as background noise, because you're not you don't need to pay attention to the plot.
You're in some kind of pretty unsavory club, and this is projected onto the wall, maybe silently. And it makes sense in that context.
Yeah, well, it's a TV. It's playing on a TV in a bar.
Exactly. And you can't hear it. Oh, okay.
You're like, oh, this is a film with Brad Pitt with the weird hair.
Because it's visually striking.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some good shots. When I say it's visually striking, I don't mean it's kind of very aesthetically considered or interesting. It's just got a bunch of stuff in it that you note, like Brad Pitt's weird hair, Nick Cave as an albino.
Yeah. So maybe, but I don't think multiple rewatches, I don't understand what multiple rewatches would give you. Like, what? Because this film is it's like a music video.
And yeah, you're also never, despite it being constantly unsure of itself, or like giving you a sense, it wants you to feel like you think it's unsure of itself, kind of, as well. But It's never, like, surprising.
No.
It never takes a wild turn. It just doesn't do stuff.
I actually think, in that New York Times piece that we were reading before, Pitt said something which I think inadvertently explains the film. He was asked, who is the audience for this film? And he said, people who like overcast days.
Yeah.
I think...
And then he's pushed on that and he says, it meanders.
Yeah.
Which is true.
I think what he's actually talking about is pretentious people.
Oh, that's interesting.
Oh, I love overcast days. Yeah. Oh, it's just a great... Because most people, if you ask them, do you love overcast days? They'd be like, well, it depends on the context. Depends what I've got to do. Yeah. Someone who says to you, hey, you know, my name's Joseph Urban, I love overcast days.
You put it in your Tinder profile.
Yeah, you'd be like, fuck this person. Yeah,
it's true.
Sure, yeah. I don't feel strongly either way, actually, mate. I got a life to live. And if it's rainy, well then, sometimes that's good, sometimes that's bad.
Exactly.
So, I think this is a film... What if people like this?
If people like this film.
If you like Overcast Days, fuck you.
Yeah, we don't want you in the audience.
No, that's not true.
No. Give us 5 stars, please, still.
If people like Johnny Suede, I don't want to insult people. It's not just for pretentious people. Suede.
Joseph, we spent the first 15 minutes of this podcast talking about this film's violent misogyny. So I'm not ready to forgive the fans of Johnny Suede quite yet. I can imagine someone finding this interesting and, like, being compelled by parts of it, totally.
You could say that this film is not politically engaged.
Something is not always,
enough.
Like, resolved by its politics, obviously.
No, exactly. You could be, like... You could choose to just switch off from that part, and you could choose to view it...
I mean, take back calling that politics, by the way. It's ethics.
Yeah, it is ethics. That's true. Well, I mean, to talk about ethics, like... But this is because philosophy is a different project from cinema. But, like, Immanuel Kant, in... his most famous passage, like famous German philosopher, 18th century German philosopher, Immanuel Kant, who wrote a lot about ethics, in the most famous passage where he spells out his project most clearly.
Which is rare for him. He takes a long time to say anything.
Yeah. He makes an incredibly racist offhand remark about people who live in Papua New Guinea. It's not necessary. But the crazy thing is, because every philosophy student gets given that section of Kant... Everyone gets given Kant at his most violent racist. And he doesn't... It's literally... He's saying, like, people are lazy, particularly those who live in Papua New Guinea. Kant. It's a genuine little moment.
No, that's so awful.
But, you know, you can dismiss that out of hand and you can turn it off and you can be like, that's just his context. He didn't know. He had reason to know. He should have fucking been like, why would everyone from some country be racist?
I'm not forgiving Immanuel Kant for that. I'm not saying like throw out the categorical imperative, but...
That's my point. You can find value in Immanuel Kant with... Why are you laughing at me, Dan?
Look, I'm not following you all the way to the end of this comparison.
No.
I see where you're going and I understand it.
I think people could watch Johnny Suede...
He's not Immanuel Kant.
And he's not, I know. But people could watch Johnny Suede and be like... I can ignore the worst stuff. I can switch it off.
I think it's... I disagree, sort of.
You just think you can't ignore
it.
I
don't think because you can never ignore unethical decisions in a film. I think it's kind of end up being in the film's bones, right?
That's
like,
true.
I'm not saying that you can't see things in that film and think, oh, that's artful, or that's compelling, or that's interesting. But... I think to say you like this film is to raise some pretty weird questions what you want out of entertainment or art.
That's true. I think, it's true.
Like, I'm not saying that means... Yeah.
There are some films which I think are, you know, probably, like, are interesting and important in certain ways. But if someone told me that was their favourite film and they liked that, I would be like... I mean, this is a fucking... And I'm not wading into this conversation, I promise. Because Dan will...
Lenny Riefenstahl.
I'm going to bring up Lenny Riefenstahl. I'm sorry, Dan.
That's fine.
There's always this discussion about Lenny Riefenstahl. Like, is she valuable? Has she added value to cinema? My answer to that is she added techniques. But if you're someone who watches The Triumph of the Will and gives it 5 stars on Letterboxd and you're like, that's a great film, there's... You've misunderstood something.
Sure.
She can give you techniques, but it's an ad for Hitler. And if you want to see the techniques, see someone who uses the techniques later. And anyway, Riefenstahl is over... Sometimes the viewer misses out on Dan's face of just like... He's just trying to see his way out of this room. Like, his mind is like running for the door when I start saying some of this shit. Riefenstahl's contributions to cinema.
Really taken it to the Germans in this episode.
I know. Sorry, Germans. Riefenstahl's cinematic contributions are overstated anyway. Okay. She just shot crowds in an interesting way.
All right.
And lots of people shoot crowds. Sure. Lots of people do it better and aren't friends with Adolf Hitler.
Yeah. So, what is the takeaway from this? Then just go watch films. Watch Jim Jarmusch films. Although, Patterson, I actually found, just to...
Stop talking about Jarmusch Lenny Riefenstahl.
Well, no, it's fine. But as a Jarmusch film I saw recently, also just has a really...
That's got terrible politics with women.
Portrayal of a woman.
Yeah.
Just, yeah. I don't want to accuse the entire mumblecore movement of misogyny, but...
Jarmusch is... When I was 16 years old, I was extremely into Jim Jarmusch and I was extremely into Sonic Youth. And I'm extremely not into those two things for the same reason, that they're a little bit tiresome.
That's true.
And you kind of burn out on both of those things. You go like, oh, I see the trick and I see how once this was my entire world, but now I see other people who've adopted the trick and do more interesting things with it.
Let's use that as a segue to talk about Nicolas Cage.
Sure.
Yeah.
Who interesting.
He's pretty good in this film.
He is.
He might be as good as Brad Pitt. In terms of fulfilling... No. I just meant... Well, actually, okay, that's not true.
Embodying
the vibe of the film and feeling like, oh, if everyone in the film was like this, it would be... The acting would be all great.
Because Brad Pitt is very good in this film.
Brad Pitt's so good. We'll get to Brad Pitt.
He's really good. Are you laughing because we're saying we'll get to podcast about Brad Pitt?
It's true.
That's the fun of this podcast.
No, I love it. Nick Cave.
Who's someone we have divided opinions on, I think.
So I thought The Skeleton Tree was an extraordinary album. I think The Boatman's Call. I think he's got a bunch of wonderful...
Of course you like the maudlin fucking Woe Is Me albums.
That's all I'm all about it.
All about how sad I am that God's abandoned me.
Yeah.
Daniel Dixon, you're a parody.
Into my arms.
I could tell you that without you even answering that question.
They're genuinely beautiful. And they're beautiful because they're sparse.
Yeah.
And whenever Nick Cave does excess, I... turn off.
I'm all about the birthday party more than Nick Cave. I'm about gross Nick the stripper.
Sure.
Like crazy saxophones, like sounds like it's been dragged across the floor for 2 hours. That's my Nick Cave. And sometimes I get irritated by the respectability stuff he does these days.
Yeah, which I think, to be honest, I think that's pretty... I don't think it's a surprise that he does the respectability stuff because he's always wanted to be seen as kind of a Dylan-esque troubadour.
A poet and prince.
An intellect.
Yeah.
But an intellect who shuns the other intellectuals because he's too cool.
Yeah.
And he's, you know... And also, he's sometimes a wonderful songwriter. He's an incredible... I've seen him live a couple of times. An incredible stage presence. But he is... He thinks too highly of himself. And I think that's just murder. Like, you just cannot be... You cannot do his shtick and think too highly of yourself. Because it's lame. It comes off at, like, you've got to be as smart as you think you are when you're using big words. That's just the bargain you strike. Like, sure. And I don't think he quite gets there. I will enjoy the hell out of a Nick Cave concert. Really like some of his music. But it does make me cringe a little bit.
The serial killer stuff.
He thinks he's so cool. I like cool. The
serial killer stuff.
He's got hair plugs, too. Yeah, anyway, that's fine. Whatever you want to do. Don't judge anyone's...
I like him when he's, like, horny murderer. And then he bypasses that stuff. When he's the Grinder Man stuff, when it's, like, no pussy blues and it's, like...
That's rough.
You don't like that?
I think it's rough.
That's my preferred Nick Cave.
Well, I guess he's playing into the character in kind of a fun way.
Mm.
I don't know.
You don't like that?
I think Into My Arms is just a perfect encapsulation of what he does best, which is... simple, sad, just a piano in his voice, making declarative statements that are poetic and elegant, but not over-flourished. And that's what I want.
Of course you do.
Well, this is the only thing I like.
It's true. Is that true?
It's the thing I like the most.
I made you watch...
I like Mountain Goats.
Whatchamahoosie, Drag Me to Hell the other day. That film doesn't resemble that in any way.
Exactly, but that's, for me, I think... And I think when we were talking about Casablanca the other day, I was kind of trying to establish ceilings of quality, right? Like, when we were on the Cutting Class episode. And I think there's a way in which I... Drag Me to Hell, which we watched for Halloween, and I had a blast, is an excellent film for what it is, which is just operating in a much smaller bubble... than anything.
I don't think like, that's
and I, true. I don't. I again, we've had this conversation before, so I don't want to hop on like my snob concerns. But maybe it's because I'm a snob. But I just think it limits itself by what it's doing, and that's fine. But for me, it's not doing things that can make it a great film.
I don't agree.
Yeah,
because what's great cinema for me? Great cinema is awe. If I'm awed by something, that's great cinema. I don't want to. I want my rational faculties as Immanuel cancelled Kant would say.
We can keep Kant.
His definition of the sublime was that your rational faculties fail. You're trying to comprehend something and you just can't. You break down. You stop. That's what like transcendence is.
In order for that to happen, your rational faculties need to come up against them. And my rational faculties were perfectly capable of contending with Drag Me to Hell. I knew what it was. And it was... doing fun things.
But you can't predict it. And then it does it. Else. And it's... And it... That's transcendence, Daniel.
It's something like transcendence.
Daniel has his arms crossed, by the way.
It's enjoyment.
I know.
It's pleasure. That's pleasure. Pleasure and transcendence are different things.
No.
I think that is somewhere where you and I don't, like, disagree. And I don't think we disagree in terms of... Like, again, I don't think Drag Me to Hell is a bad movie. I think it's a great little film, but I think it's a great little film.
I don't think that's true. I think most of these films, like fucking Tree of Life that we'll talk about, that want to be like the most major films are tiny to me, microscopic.
I think you take a much greater risk when you step up for that kind of ambition because you can just, if you drop the ball at all, it's a catastrophe.
Nah, I think that project is. I don't want cinema to explain the universe to me. Thank you very much. I'm quite fine. I want to see... an old gypsy woman get an anvil dropped on her head and all her brains splosh out in someone's face.
Sure, that is definitely where you and I differ. I don't not want to see that. I'm perfectly happy to see that. I'm just... It's not doing anything spectacular for me. I'm like, okay, sure. I get what this is. I sound like such a dick.
If there's one thing that I believe more than anything, it's that you have to stand by your... aesthetic and creative choices.
Intuitions, maybe, more than choices.
And you have to not worry about sounding pretentious or like a dick.
All right, I appreciate your... I was going to say I appreciate your permission, which sounded sarcastic, but it was truthful.
My favourite thing is to encounter someone with a... My least favourite kind of... not least favourite. My least favourite kind of person. No, the person who I have the least... generative discussion with is someone whose favorite films are films that I think I have enough reason to think that they're just saying that because the critics said that.
Sure.
Even if you can really argue to me why, like, Apocalypse Now, Godfather, Back to the Future are the best, but you have to believe it, and you have to really strongly think it, and you have to have strong opinions. That's what I want. I want to have a conversation with you, and definitely. I can only have a conversation with you if you really believe what you're saying.
The reason we have this podcast, and our friends, I think, not exclusively, but certainly the reason we have this podcast, is because we're people with strong intuitions who then spend a lot of time justifying them.
I think that's true. And I'm so excited when someone has intuitions that don't make sense to me.
Oh, yeah.
Or surprise me.
Yeah, definitely. Because otherwise there's no conversation.
Exactly. Bradley J. Pitts. We should...
Is the best he has been in this film for his entire career. By a long way. He is accomplished. He is assured. He is still beautiful, although the hair is not doing him any favours.
His hair collapses by the end, actually, because Catherine Keener tries to pull it out, which is part of the regressive politics. Yeah.
All the women in this, and I use this term advisedly, are shrews. That's the kind of presentation of the woman.
The first woman who the relationship falls apart with, she comes back one time way later, and we hear from the partner who beats her. He says
is
to
that
Brad
in a dream,
Pitt,
though?
Maybe it's a dream.
I think that's in a dream.
The film starts throwing up a lot of dreams for no reason.
For no reason that aren't that well framed. The partner does, although we learn later that one thing that is in a dream is true, which is the shoe on the roof of the car. But
the partner says she misses you about the first woman, which is crazy.
Not that this film needs a generous reading, because if this reading that I'm about to give were to be true, then this film was incompetent and still failing. But sure, we're not meant to dislike Brad Pitt, but he's not giving reasons to any of these women to like him or to want to spend time with him or to want to be in a relationship with him.
No.
And I think the film's aware of that. The film's aware that he's juvenile.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
So the women aren't being cast as completely, you know, unhinged. They are rational characters in terms of responding to Brad Pitt negatively.
Who's a dumbass
and who deserves to be rejected. It just is still not doing a good enough job of making them, you know,
real people.
Real people.
With agency.
Yeah. Because that's the thing. Even though Brad Pitt's not a real person, he has agency.
Yeah.
But
He is perfect in this film.
He inhabits the myth.
So he understands that he's playing someone's idea of an American legend.
There are a few moments where he needs to kind of put on a front, where he needs to pretend to be something that he isn't, or like that he doesn't, like to act to impress people or to try, you know, to perform. And Pitt conveys the idea of not quite successfully accomplishing a performance so well.
I'll make this brief. It's not really a tangent. It will sound like a tangent.
Sure.
I'm getting extremely into, or not again, I've been into it for a long time. I'm rediscovering with a great fervor the films of American director John Cassavetes, who's someone who I've always loved. Cassavetes was a director. He made a bunch of films that he funded through his acting work. So he was like an actor. He was very handsome. He'd be in movies and like weird TV shows. Take the money from that and go and make these incredibly painful portraits of like American suburbia character-led. He had just finished making a film called Husbands, which was him. He stars in it with fucking Ben Gazzara and Peter Falk, who plays Columbo.
Have you seen the late night interview of that?
This is what I'm about to tell you. You've seen that too?
I've seen the interview, yeah.
I didn't know how widely this was disseminated.
It actually came up in an academic seminar I was at.
Wow.
That was talking about Columbo.
Wow.
And I was linked into it.
So there, Cassavetes, Gazzara, and Falk go on...
Johnny Carson?
Not Carson. He was on Dick Cavett. So it was Cassavetes, Falk, and Gazzara went on to talk about that film. And they are obviously extremely sourced. They come out.
Yeah.
They don't talk to Cavett. Like, he's trying to talk to them. They just won't. And they're like...
I am interested to see how this links back in.
I've been thinking about it a lot. So it's like, these three men are being really hostile. They keep like touching him. They keep doing pratfalls. They're making him quite uncomfortable. He leaves at one point and they kind of pretend to interview each other. The audience chant like, "We want Dick." So they're like, the audience aren't buying it.
Mm.
And they're just like...
They all apologised afterwards, by the way, I think. Or at least a few of them did.
Did they?
I think Cassavetes and Fork, I think. I could be wrong about that, but I know there was an apology.
And what's... So, there... And Fork is the one who's like... He's not facing Cabot, and he's also being difficult and unpleasant, but he's doing so in a way that, like, is more melodramatic. He's, like, staring into middle distance.
That's right.
When I saw that interview clip, I was like, I have never better seen an illustration of men inhabiting toxic masculinity uncomfortably. Because they're performing their masculinity. They're being bro-y.
They think it's a joke as well. They think they're parodying themselves, I think.
Cassavetes keeps trying to, like, cajole Fork into talking about women's lib in a way that makes it sound like Cassavetes is going to say something extremely regressive, and he's, like, smirking about it. And then the facade drops away, and they get worse and worse at playing it, and they get more and more uncomfortable, and then they try and talk about the movie, and Cassavetes, they're, like, finally talking about Husbands, which is a work about toxic masculinity. They're finally talking about it, and then Cassavetes, Fork is, like, being, like, you know, it's a beautiful film. We tried to talk about what it's like to be friends with other men and what's that like. And Cassavetes goes like, shut up. They don't want to hear it. And instantly re-inhabits the role of the toxic man. And when I saw it, I was like, yeah, this is the best illustration of how it's a performance, how you inhabit it. I thought that. And then today I rewatched Johnny Suede. And Johnny Suede to me is also in the performance of Brad Pitt, a film about inhabiting toxic male roles, not liking them, not wearing them well. They're like a jacket, but as soon as you get emotionally vulnerable, you run to them.
You know what the best example of that is, actually? Is when Brad Pitt is boasting about his sexual performance to his friend Deke, and it's clearly a put on. It's like a child talking about, you know, sex. Women's bodies, sex. Yeah, he's describing how he
found the clitoris,
with great... So he's so thrilled about it, and, you know, really this is going to advance him in the world. And it's played quite sweetly, but he's clearly trying to posture as a masculine guy and failing spectacularly without realizing it. Because Deke's
like, you didn't know where that was. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, that's true. It's about using masculinity, putting it on sometimes, taking it off other times, and hating it. That's the big thing from the Cassavetes interview.
Well, how it's for other people, right? Yeah. That's the...
Yeah. What do men look like? Men don't perform alone like that. When men are alone, that's when the crushing sadness creeps in.
Believe you me.
It's about a failure to perform.
In which case, it's about relationships with other people, right? And the ways in which those are inevitably failures.
Yeah.
This kind of sense of... For someone like Johnny Suede, who's trying so, like, I mean, you can read this film as him being unable to socially connect with others. The only way he can think of to do that is to inhabit kind of a character archetype, which comes with all this particular baggage, which he feels compelled to inhabit, like not on a conscious level, but at a kind of subconscious level. And then that just breaks things down further, because this film does not have a happy ending. Not really. I don't think it does. His shoe disappears. I think the shoe disappears. So the shoe is thrown at him by Catherine Keener, which replicates a weird trope that repeats in this film, which is window shattering. The shoe flies through the window. And then at the end of the film, so one of his suede shoes, which are profoundly important to him, he returns to Catherine Keener after he's you know, left her apartment after assaulting her, and apologizes, and she doesn't say anything, and then you see the shoe drive off into the sunset on top of a car. So it went out the window, landed on the roof of a car, and drives away. And I think there's a sense of kind of loss. I mean, I guess you can read it as him losing his character because his hair's descended as well. That could be a different way of
reading it.
He's a human being. He's not just a caricature.
See, don't you think... I mean, this film does have regressive politics, but don't you think this is the first time we've been able to make claims like, do you think the film was doing this? And the answer is probably yes.
Yeah.
DiCillo is smart enough to know that he's thinking about character archetypes. He's thinking about Pitt's character.
Yeah.
It's a long shot from fucking Sandy Tung with Across the Tracks.
Oh, absolutely. But we've been working with a pretty low bar.
The
lowest of bars. Thelma and Louise... Actually, no, Thelma and Louise, you can say it's trying to do this and succeeding. Definitely. Remember we watched the TV edit?
Don't blame us.
Email thebradpittcast@gmail.com with any concerns.
There's the... I guess the last thing I want to say about Bradley J. Pitts is there is a moment in this film where I think it's a dream sequence ultimately, but Kina says something to him and he's looking at her and then his face collapses. He like scrunches up in and bursts into tears.
Yeah.
And it's almost embarrassing, like you have this cringe.
Yeah.
It's a spectacular moment. It's a
wonderful performance. There's a few moments where the Brad Pitt and Nah, where he's
There's
one of those that is not just wonderful because it references other Brad Pitt performances, but wonderful in its kind of the totality of him inhabiting it in the moment. There's these kind of I think this is the film, here's my claim about Johnny Suede, where his physical and emotional expression aligns perfectly for the first time. They are in harmony. Yeah. And that has not happened before. In The Dark Side of the Sun, they were radically out of whack.
Mm-hmm.
And you were getting a lot of the physical expression, then enormous emotional expression. Neither was ever in line. It was very confusing. In Across the Tracks, you get a lot of the emotion. You get the yelling. In what else have we seen?
Cutting Class.
That's right. Cutting Class is pretty good.
He's
not as ambitious. Or sometimes he goes too overboard and is just too physical. But it's kind of a cartoon of a film, so it kind of works. In Thelma and Louise, it's just all about the physical and you're never that interested in his emotions. Here, he suddenly worked out somehow how to be a believable, kind of larger than life, but coherent and compelling and human character whose universe is like compatible. It makes sense.
Yeah.
And it's the emotional and the physical, because the physical is so important with Pitt. The way in which when he emphatically rejects something, he kind of moves like away from the person he's rejecting. The way in which he, like, when he's excited, his body is kind of charged with energy. Or when he's sad, how he just dissolves completely. I think those things are really at play in here. And that is enjoyable to watch. Especially enjoyable to watch in the context of having seen the four films in the lead up to this. And the radical, I mean, who knows how much credit DiCillo can take for this, but the radical improvement.
He's nailed it.
He seems comfortable
He's suddenly nailed it in a way. I mean, he's good in Thelma and Louise. He's really good in Thelma and Louise. But this is like...
Well, this is new thing on screen, right? Other people could have played the character in Thelma and Louise. Yeah. Johnny Suede is Pitt.
Yeah. Do you know something, Daniel Dixon?
Joseph.
I really like Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
I love to watch him. I love to talk about him.
Good thing you're doing this podcast.
I love to think about him. When he clicks,
it's like nothing else.
No one does that.
Well, also because, I mean, I'll have time to explore this down the track, I guess, but it seems to have something to do with the fact that it's a surprise. That you don't actually, like, you see this guy, you see his... It seems like he should be out of place in every movie he's in, because he's such a presence and he's making such decisions.
Staccato, weird choices constantly. Yeah. He's like a fucking Jerry Lewis in the body of, like, some hunk.
It's bizarre. Absolutely. Yeah. Or Jimmy Stewart as well, actually.
Yeah.
You know, I think the Jimmy Stewart and Brad Pitt might have a fair bit be aligned because they are this outsized physical.
They have to play weird people.
Warbling kind of. Yeah. They have to play weirdos.
You can't. It's like you can't just put Jimmy Stewart in a film and just have everyone treat him like another human being.
Yeah. Everyone has to be shocked that this person is in the room.
Yeah.
And Brad Pitt works so well for that.
Yeah. He's a good actor.
We like Brad Pitt.
I hope he gets nominated for an Oscar. If only for me. He doesn't care.
No, he doesn't.
But if he wins an Oscar, we've got like 4 months of Brad Pitt discourse, baby.
That's true. Yeah, we might start a New York Times style daily news podcast about Brad Pitt.
Yeah. Fucking
the Bradley.
He'll be the Bradley. The Bradley. Dan, quick, go out and fucking get the domain name quickly. Get the email address so we don't have to even fucking some bastardization of it because someone stole BradPittCast@gmail.com
somehow. That is crazy.
I wanted to do something which I don't think should become a regular segment.
All right.
But I'd like to do it. I would like to look at some Letterboxd reviews.
I know you say, I'm happy either way. You know we've done this before.
That's what I said. So we've done it once before in a way that makes it sound like...
You mean you don't want it to be a segment we do every time?
We don't have to do it every time.
It's not an obligation.
But we've done it before and it was funny and I had a really great time last time. Okay, so I'd like to do it again.
Let's see. I mean, that's the logic.
This is a Letterboxd review by someone who we should personally go out and tell us to listen to this podcast. Because their Letterboxd name is Bahad Pitt. Brahad Pitt. Spelt with a had in the middle.
Okay.
Their top four films are... Fight Club, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Ad Astra, and Interstellar for some reason.
I wonder what their top four films were a year ago. before Ad Astra and Once Upon a Time.
And their Twitter profile name is XRad Pitt.
Okay.
So this person is our target audience. XRad Pitt, if you're listening now, we love you. This podcast has been waiting for you.
I'm going to wait till I hear the review to pass my judgment.
I just love it, dude. It's funny and enjoyable and smart. And this is something, bringing up something we did not talk about.
Mm.
Also, Brad Pitt's singing voice. I'm in love.
I don't think it's very good. I love Brad Pitt.
At certain times, it's better than other times. There are times where I think it kind of works. Now, this is an insane review.
Okay.
That was the reason why I wanted to have this conversation.
Sure.
It's written by someone called Zach Caddy, who we've done this a couple of times. Let's do it again. Zach Caddy's four favorite films are Raising Arizona. Great film.
Yeah, it is.
What We Do in the Shadows. Funny.
It's pretty. I like What We Do in the Shadows. Yeah, I laughed a lot. I'm always looking for just comedy films that are just funny.
And it's really just funny.
Like, and that's one of the reasons I kind of like Adam McKay as well, because he's done a bunch of comedy films. I know this is not an original opinion, but I'm sick of comedy films with themes.
Yeah.
I'm aware of depression. I know that life's tough. I want to laugh.
Yeah, that's true.
And there's so few of those. And What We Do in the Shadows, sure, the characters were sad sometimes, but it was a comedy. It's actually also why I like Taika Waititi, is because I think even though his films, well, he knows how to be funny.
He's funny. And that
laugh, you know, you're not dealing with a long act of a Taika Waititi film in it without a joke.
No.
And I think What We Do in the Shadows does that really well.
Yeah. Brianna and I constantly quoted each other when one of the vampires goes like, "Would you like some buschetti?"
It's good. It's good. A lot of good stuff.
His other two favorite films are The Revenant. Weird. I don't like that film.
I haven't
film.
Seen it, but I don't think I would like it.
Love and Mercy, the Brian Wilson biopic, which is interesting. Sure. Might.
You know, I think that is half an extraordinary film and half a pretty dull film.
I've always been fond of that film because, I guess I'm just putting it here at this point, I have bipolar. And I think it's one of the best on-screen depictions of bipolar.
Interesting.
When Wilson is young, the noise thing, the sound thing.
That's right, yeah. It's his sensitivity to the world.
The mania is really captured well.
Do you think it's a good film?
No.
Okay.
I think Paul Dano is great.
I think the Paul Dano sections are like, that's, I can't, maybe I just want to watch a documentary about the Beach Boys because that's kind of what that is.
Sure.
But I really like that. And Giamatti's okay. But
it should have been a miniseries. I think it should be like 100 hours long.
John Cusack, right?
Yeah.
That's weird.
Cusack is, what the
Yeah, what's he doing?
What would this podcast be like if we were just doing Cusack? That would be weird. Anyway, Zach Caddy. So here we go. I think he's joking. But who knows? He gave the film 1 star. If Brad Pitt were my dad, I would remind him of this film's existence every day. He would take my ribbing in stride, give me a gentle noogie, and then we go on a long walk. I love that. I love that part.
Sure.
This last two sentences make me... I was hoping this was going to be my new favorite movie so I could own the normies with it. Oh, well.
Okay. I mean, there's some confusing things going
There's
on
some
there.
Honesty I about the fact we were, that it's not great.
That's true. I don't want to do this, but if we were to look at the person's other reviews, you might get a sense of the context of that tone. I don't think we need to do that. Dear listener, you can go and do that yourself if you feel the urge. But I think,
I want to do two more.
Okay.
Because this person's seems like they're actually going to be my new best friend. Their top four favorite films are the Doug Liman film Go, which is...
Never heard of it.
Insane. Doug Liman made, like... He made Edge of Tomorrow, where Tom Cruise get killed a bunch of times.
Wasn't that going to be called something else?
Or was All it... You Need Is Kill, which is a fantastic title.
It's a much better name.
His other three favourite films are Nowhere, the Gregoraki film, Wild, I love Gregoraki.
John Lennon? No, that's
Nowhere Boy. Oh, Iraqi is like a very important... Dan, I love you, that's probably the straightest thing I've ever heard you say. Gregoraki is like a really important, subversive, weird, queer artist.
Okay, I'm so sorry. I actually
Nowhere
feel like
Boy
I've
is about John Lennon.
Gregoraki.
He made Mysterious Skin. He flirted with the mainstream. It looked like he was going to be a deal, and then he went back and made like weird, horny films.
Mm-hmm.
Southland Tales.
Oh, with The Rock.
Yes.
And Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Yes.
Are you still recording?
We got like 10 minutes to go.
Sorry.
No, that's all right. That's all right. We might leave this in.
Do you want to say anything, Brianna? Did you love listening to your Thelma and Louise episode back?
I haven't listened to it.
Did you maybe ask if we could scrub it from the internet?
It's good. Oh, no. You come off really well. Bye.
We're almost done. And Josh's fourth favourite film is H2O, the second attempt at a Halloween reboot. Which I assume
you've seen.
It's directed by Steve Miner, who's a really great slasher director.
Okay. Is it good?
Oh, listen to that thunder.
It's thunder.
Holy moly. H2O is not so good.
Okay.
But Miner is a good slasher director. This person has said, it's a really great review. This is what another reason why I think Josh is going to be my best friend.
Okay.
A mess. Dull, boring, aimless. But I was entertained for the 30 seconds of screen time Samuel L. Jackson got.
It was exciting.
Also, Catherine Keener comes from the Natasha Lyonne school of what do you mean she's straight women?
Oh, yeah. I buy that.
That's great.
I should say, I really like Catherine Keener.
She's the best.
She is very... She might be the most kind of humanly compelling person in it, even more than Brad Pitt. Because Brad Pitt is kind of playing this character. He's given a lot to work with. And Catherine Keener is not given much to work with, and she keeps it very believable.
She plays everything with real. Deep
humanity.
She can't it's be extraordinary. She her can't voice tell as a well. Lie.
Oh, I'm in love with her.
Catherine Keener can't tell a lie.
Yeah.
You know, a couple of weeks ago, I had a dream that I directed a film.
Okay.
Set in a kitchen in Texas, in which Catherine Keener played the head chef of this crummy restaurant.
Okay.
Who was going through cancer and was bald and was very mean to everyone.
Gotta make it.
Doesn't that sound good?
Yeah, it sounds great.
It's better than... One time I had a dream that no one had ever made a film set in a prison before.
Oh, interesting.
And I woke up and I was like, I'm going to be the fucking first person to make a film.
What a shame.
Johnny Spade. Let's slot it into our Brad Pitt films. We don't have to reorder them all. Okay. Is it at the bottom? No, because Pitt's so good.
Pitt's it has too to be good. Towards it's better than the Dark Side of the Sun.
Yeah. It's better than Across the Tracks.
It's better than Across the Tracks.
I think it's more interesting to me than Ad Astra.
I disagree.
Okay.
There's so many metrics of evaluation, right? I'm not recommending this to anyone unless they're interested in a set of very specific things.
But I'm recommending
Ad Astra to a bunch of people.
No, you are not.
It's fine. It's got some good bits. It's
Who
exciting
would you
to look
recommend
at.
Ad
My
Astra?
Friends.
Dan.
I think it's. I'm not saying you must rush out and see it, but if there's a chance to stream something of an evening and you're looking for a space movie, I'll say, yeah, watch Ad Astra. Brad Pitt's good in it. There's some wonderful set pieces. Absolutely. I think your hate of that film has kind of self-replicated or something. I think it's amplified. It's burning on its own fuel.
There's no set of requirements where I say Ad Astra is the recommendation.
Check it out for the moon buggy chase. Check it out for...
If you want that shit, watch Gravity.
Okay, but that doesn't have Brad Pitt in it.
No, just watch Gravity and imagine that Brad Pitt's... He could be the George Maybe, Clooney character.
Sure.
Have you seen Gravity?
No.
Damn.
Look, but you knew this. When you signed up for this podcast, I have seen a limited number of films.
When you said sure, I was like, Dad, I know what's going on here.
Johnny Swade's got some real genuine problems and some moments. I'm just summing this up. This is my summary.
I know.
Johnny Swade's got some real genuine problems and some quiet, entertaining moments.
The thunder is crazy.
The thunder is crazy. I do not know if it's being picked up on the mic. If not, you're going to just have to imagine the thunder. But
it kind of feels
a storm
like
rolling in.
It. You know, whenever thunder happens, it makes me think about King Lear. So it kind of feels like it's Lear's like climactic speech, but it's a fucking Brad Pitt podcast.
Makes me weep every time.
King Lear.
Yeah.
Good play. William Shakespeare.
The best.
Knew what he was doing.
Uncontroversial opinions again.
Lear is my favorite.
Me too.
Shakespeare.
It's perfect. Her voice was ever soft, gentle, and low, an excellent thing in a woman.
Yeah.
Said ironically, obviously, probably not the best line from King Lear on the Johnny Spade podcast, but what the hell.
What's next, then? If you have to rank Shakespeare, is it Hamlet next? Hamlet for me.
Yeah, I really like The Tempest. The Tempest is wondrous. Yeah, I think it's his last play.
Yeah, it's after the twins die.
Yeah, and it's about writing. He's a magician, but it's about writing.
I'd never really thought about The Tempest in that way.
Hamlet, obviously.
In very tellingly me, I really like Titus Andronicus.
I have never read it or seen it. It's too... I mean, I don't want to see someone forced to eat their parent or child in the pie, right?
That's great.
No, not turn up, a huge turn off for Dan.
Tamor. Julie Tamor, who...
Oh, yeah.
Did The Lion King on Broadway. She made a Titus film. It's really good.
Okay.
Really
good.
Do
I want to see it?
Yes. It's beautiful. And it's like... a 5-star film that people do not talk about enough.
Interesting. Turn Off the Dark. That was Julie Taymor's.
Yeah, and all the Spider-Man kept dying.
Have you seen the The musical set piece, A Freak Like Me Needs Company. Is it
of Turn Off the Dark?
From Turn Off the Dark. No. Yeah, we'll watch it after the podcast. Go on, treat yourself. Look up Letterman, A Freak Like Me Needs Company. It's a musical sequence in which the Green Goblin sings from Turn Off the Dark, and it's one of the most spectacularly awful things I've ever seen.
Tamor is... We could do a podcast with as many episodes about Julie Tamor.
Okay.
The Lion King on Broadway, yeah, that's wild. Like, is massive, and it's so weird. And she makes, like, four films. She makes a Beatles musical across the universe. You know what?
I'm pretty sure I saw her in New York being interviewed with Jeffrey Eugenides about her eight favourite films.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. It was this weird Pierpont Morgan Library, no one's interested in this, event where two, like, intellects were interviewed about their films. It just happened to be on when I was in Manhattan.
What was her favourite film?
I have no memory. I'm sure I can look it up. I think I wrote them down, actually. I'll have to find
it. Do you think she would just list, like, The Lion King? Spider-Man?
I think it was a bunch of kind of weird Italian shit from the 70s.
That sounds like Julie Tamor. Yeah. She's a wackadoo. I love Julie Tamor, but she's like... when I don't live on the same planet as Julie Tamor. You know, whenever I listen back to these episodes, my favourite part is always the last 15 minutes. And so when we're recording it, I always want to keep it going because it's just this insane... We
lose the structure.
Yeah.
And that's...
the point.
I guess. I mean, we want to keep a hold of Brad Pitt.
Oh, sure. Because he's the best.
In our arms.
Do you know what next week's episode is?
A River Runs Through It.
What the fuck are we going to do?
I know this film only through your warnings of it.
I'm just really nervous. It's not... we've never before had a film that is long and slow. We've had films like that. Films. They're long, it's long, it's slow, but it doesn't make radical choices.
What if? You know what we could do? Look, maybe I shouldn't even say this on the podcast because it might be a terrible idea. We could... no, we won't do that.
What were you going to say?
I was going to say we could record the podcast while watching it, but the sound would be...
I sometimes think that. The sound would be fucked up and... that would mean that the episode would be like 2.5 hours long.
Well, I was just going to think we could like start it halfway through or something and be like, here we are watching, because we would have to keep listening to it. And if we're like have headphones half listening to the movie, I mean,
maybe it should be a really hot day and we should do something crazy like run a cable into the yard and watch it outside.
Okay, make a swimming pool. But we could invite a bunch of other people around.
That would be an unpleasant thing to do to our friends. I don't hate anyone that much. Okay. Speaking of Drag Me to Hell, you know at the end where she has to give the button to someone?
Yeah.
That's what inviting someone to see a river runs through it is like.
Okay, fair enough. We won't do that.
And then we get to talk about Robert Redford, though.
Okay.
Which I know you're hankering for.
Thurston. Yeah, I can't wait.
Thanks so much for listening to the episode of the Brad Pitt Cast.
This was an interesting episode. We don't need to evaluate it on the podcast, but...
it's such a weird film.
Well, I feel like...
do you recommend it?
No. I can't.
You really don't?
No. Joe. It's not that good.
It's got Brad Pitt. Interesting.
Here's what I'll tell you. If you're recording a podcast about Brad Pitt and you have to watch every Brad Pitt film, check out Johnny Suede. Otherwise, no need.
No. If you're a Brad Pitt completist, this is a film to look forward to. That's the difference.
It's a film you will be able to tolerate. Yeah.
It's better than that, Dan.
I didn't... oh, maybe I watched it on a different day. I have a great time. It was fine.
What? Oof. Was it picked up on the mic?
I mean, you can see little waves. That was a real crack of thunder.
It really makes it feel like we're in the middle of Frankenstein and we're just up here in my hot room talking about Brad Pitt. Let's go.
Yeah.
We didn't have music this time. Maybe we'll
have music next time. The future is a strange place. A strange and unknown place.
Are you quoting something?
No, just saying some words. We love you. Thank you for listening. See you next time.
See ya.